accession number 23216, reel 12.
Colonel Corbeau, reel 12. Besides the informal social functions that you were engaging in to get on alongside the Australians, was there a lot of formal and ceremonial social activity?
No, the only ceremonial was Anzac Day, 25th of April each year, and the Queen's birthday parade at Duntroon. Those are the two big ceremonial events of the year, and both extremely impressive too. The Governor General normally used to turn out for the Duntroon parade. And then, of course, twice a year there was a passing out parade at Duntroon called the Passing Out Parade. So yes, about four events a year when we had put on one's, well, I suppose you'd call it full dress. And but otherwise it was very informal indeed. Also, of course, I had to deal with British battalions coming down from Hong Kong to do exercises. For example, we had the KSLI came down one year and did a lot of exercising up in Queensland.
Were they doing jungle training?
Jungle training, yes. Mm. I went and joined them there, yes.
You hadn't done jungle training before, had you?
I personally hadn't, no, no. Mm.
But what are the basic principles of jungle warfare that you learned when you were observing the training and taking part in it?
My dear Nigel, this is a very difficult question indeed. I wish that my uncle by marriage, who's been a Gurkha all his life, was here to answer the question for you, but he's not.
Mm. What impression did you get then of what was really important about jungle warfare?
Well, I think probably the first impression was you had to be jolly good map reader and also had to use your compass very well indeed, and also had to be very strict with your weapon too. And that's my first impressions of that. Mm. And of course, again, this everlasting thing of fitness. And being able to go on short rations too. Also being able to look after yourself. For example, could you get water from a tree, or rather like the SAS do, you know, if, I don't know what goes on as far as animal life is concerned in the jungle, but can you live off anything like that? Kill it, eat it.
Sounds more like survival training than tactical training.
Well, exactly, yes, yes. I think the tactical training was very much done, as far as I could see, very section level or platoon level. Mm. There were obviously company attacks. I don't think it was ever. I never came across anyone being taught a battalion attack in the jungle. I may be quite wrong.
It also sounds as though it's pure infantry work without much scope for.
Oh, much scope for supporting arms. Mm. That's the impression which I got. Yes, mm. I used to think, Lord be how. Awful, here you've got to go and do this particular thing. Where's the artillery? Would they find their targets? Well, of course, you could call an aircraft.
But even with an aircraft, if you're under a jungle canopy, spotting the fall of shot can't be easy.
You suddenly get casualties from your own side, yes. Mm, mm. Yes, that's all I can tell you on that one.
Mm. Were these very frequent, these British battalion visits to?
I think during my nearly 3 years in Australia, I think I had three battalions, but also in New Zealand, there was also a British Defence Liaison staff there. Mm. And they were always one service short. And during the whole time that I was in Canberra, they were short of a soldier. So the High Commissioner in Wellington, to get on to my High Commissioner, said, send me your tame soldier, we want him down here now. And that was good.
What sort of things did you have to go to New Zealand for?
When British battalion. I only went there once.
Yes.
There was a British battalion there.
What are they doing? There's no jungle in New Zealand.
No, they have a very small training area in New Zealand, because a very small army.
Yes.
It's a place called Waiuru, very near Lake Taupo. And fairly open, a bit of jungle, not very much. But it was the. I forget which battalion it was now. It was commanded by a chap who commanded the Grenadiers, who was in the Grenadiers, not commanded the particular line battalion. Very nice man indeed, and a good battalion, needless to say.
What was the terrain like then? Because there are mountains.
Oh, a lot of mountains,
aren't there? Which
Waiuru
might be useful for training.
Is at the foot of a thing called Mount Ruhupehu, which you can see the snow on the top. Yes, a lot of snow-covered mountains, the most beautiful scenery, the most lovely country. But there's a distinct difference, because it's very hard to put your finger on the button between the Australian and the New Zealander. Their accent is similar, but it is not. Mm. And one of the most terrible mistakes you can make is to mistake one for the other.
Like mistaking a Yorkshireman for a Lancastrian.
That's right. Exactly.
And what about the national temperament and the approach to military matters? Was there a distinctive difference?
Well, on a very small scale. Mm. On a very small scale, because everything was so small.
Yes.
There was very much what I could really call they were immensely proud of Freiburg, of course. Mm. And although at the time that I was there, Brigadier the Lord Ballantrae, Bernard Ferguson, he was the Governor General when I was there. Mm. But certainly the spirit of Freiburg lived on in the army in those days. Mm. But what a man.
But, I mean, did they have a similar temperament to the Australians, or did they have a
They were small, but they were professional. Mm. Yes, yes. In New Zealand, I found that people, you know, they rather shun the soldiery. They rather thought they were a breed, you know, which I found very sad indeed. As a professional soldier myself, but the ordinary man in the street in New Zealand didn't think has much opinion of a soldier.
And what about the atmosphere with regard to that question in Australia? Was it the same, or was it
no? Not? Because they were up to the neck with Vietnam, and they were very proud of what the Australian troops were doing there. Very proud indeed. So, with regard to other things, when I was in Australia. I had to go with my late wife to Papua New Guinea and visit the Pacific Island, the Pacific Islands Regiment. And my wife came as well because the High Commission were very interested in hospitals in Papua New Guinea. And as my wife had been a Royal Air Force nursing sister and a theatre sister and an SRN and an SCM, they said, well, she's the ideal person to go while you're up there. So we both went up there. Very interesting indeed.
What were the conditions like when you went on your visit?
Very primitive. Very primitive indeed. We were told that when you walk down the main high street, so-called, in Mount Hagen, which was jungle on either side and a cobbled path, was the high street. It was not an unnatural thing. We didn't in fact see this, but it was not an unnatural thing to find a girl coming down, bare-breasted, with a piglet at one breast and a babe at the other. And there was also, in addition to that, there was cannibalism going on up in the hills. Mm. Indeed, some Gurkhas went on adventure training there, and they were warned to be very careful indeed. There's cannibalism there.
Were they warned against eating or against being eaten?
I think both. But it was very interesting indeed.
What was the local military situation? What was going on with
They were the Northern Defence Regiment, really, for Australia. Mm. And of course, there had been some pretty hefty battles there during the Second World War. I went to one place where an Australian got the VC. Mm. It was a very rugged area indeed. And
were they recruiting any of the locals into a militia force or an armed police or anything?
Well, these were regular soldiers, the Pacific Islands Regiment, commanded by Australians.
And what did you make of them?
What would have happened if there'd been some sort of semi-invasion, I don't quite know. But judging by the look of them, they looked a pretty rough, tough crowd. Mm.
Did you have any opportunity to observe their level of skills?
No, I didn't. But the commanding officer told me, you've never seen anything like this before, nor will you ever see anything like it again, but I can assure you that we are an effective defence the battalion.
What sort of weapons did they have?
Oh, ordinary ones, the weapons that the army had, yes.
Straightforward infantry?
Straightforward infantry weapons, oh yes. Mm. And very good shots they were, too.
Well, that's a very important basic skill, isn't it?
Yeah, very, yes.
Were they disciplined?
Oh, yes. Mm. A lot of saluting was going on, yes.
Would they have appeared on horse guards without discredit?
with a bit of treatment from my own regiment, they ended up very well indeed.
What about the hospitals?
Oh, very primitive indeed. Mm. And Edna went into one of the maternity wards, lying under every bed, where there's a woman either going to have a baby or had a baby, and the husband slept under the bed. And the babies were wrapped up in sacking when they were born. Mm. And there was an Australian matron there, and of course they spoke literally pidgin English. And in order to introduce Edna, the matron said to the ward sister, come looky, Missy England.
How did you get on with learning pidgin? Did you find it came to you naturally?
I didn't even begin.
You didn't attempt it?
No. But certainly for some little time, Edna got known as Missy England.
Did you manage to get round Australia as a whole?
I went to every Australian state except South Australia. Mm. I don't know why I missed out South Australia. I passed through Adelaide on going from Sydney to Fremantle. I had a very unpleasant thing to go and do in Western Australia. In fact, it was in Fremantle. A British RAMC sergeant and a British nurse went absent from Singapore, and they got themselves to Australia, and they were living together.
Well, they just run away.
Yes, we ran away, yes. Mm. There was a very similar case in the paper in this country, I think, very recently. Mm. This was the same thing all over again. Mm. And I had to go. They found out where these people were in Fremantle, and I had to go as a British officer, because they were British personnel, with the Australian Provost Marshal, and arrest them, which was a job I disliked intensely. Mm. But it had to be done. I was ordered to do so I had to carry it out.
What was the procedure for doing that?
It all came through from Singapore on the on the SIB net to Canberra, to Army headquarters. And they, of course, set the trial, set the trail going in Fremantle. Mm. And they found out where these people were. And they kept an eye on them and followed them in plain clothes and so on. They didn't know they'd been followed for some time. I spoke at length to this sergeant. And I said, you've made a really nonsense of it here, haven't you? But I have a duty to do, and you're under arrest.
What did he say when he was told he was under arrest?
He said, I've asked for it, haven't I, sir? Mm. There was no resistance at all. It was the first thing in the morning, at 6:30 in the morning, went around and battered on their door, and this bedraggled-looking figure came to the door, and there was the girl in bed as well. Mm. Very unpleasant. I never have to do that again. Mm. But nevertheless, an order is an order. Mm.
What happened to them? Did you follow up the case?
Yes, they were put back under arrest on an aircraft. I think there was a normal run of an RAF aircraft from Singapore to Sydney, and they got put onto one of those and under arrest. Two separate aircraft. I gather that she came back to this country and was dealt with at the QA centre here in Aldershot, and she was discharged. I think he got quite a heavy punishment. Mm.
Did he go to jail?
No.
Mm. He was lucky.
He got reduced to the ranks. Mm. And I think got I suppose got heavily fined as well, but he didn't have to go to prison, no. Mm. But he was dismissed the army anyway. Mm.
How many British personnel did you have overall to look after? Do you have any idea of the numbers?
Yes, it was somewhere in the neighbourhood of about 30 to 40. Mm. You see, all the governors of the Australian states had a British ADC in those days. Mm. Well, they were all under my, not control, but I had to administer them. Mm. And then there were certain people, there was always a gunner there was always a sapper there was always an RAC chap there, mm. Armoured Corps chap. Who else was it? An intelligence corps chap. Mm. So in all, there were somewhere around about 30 to 40 people, I think, yes, who were on secondment to the Australian Army. Mm. I didn't see them very often.
Did it involve a great deal of administration, or were they looking after themselves?
They were very much looking after themselves, yes. Mm. I mean, their confidential reports would have to come through me and so on and so forth. Mm.
Did the Australians have a similar system of reporting?
Yes, so very similar indeed.
Presumably,
yes.
Then it was a question of sending the thing on.
Yes, and I'd be sending it on to MS from a strict radio. Yes.
Did you have anything to do with the selection of Australian officers going on similar postings to our army?
No, that would be considered an interference by a British officer.
Mm.
Oh, no, I wasn't asked to do that at all. If the need had arisen, my great friend, this RO, and I thought that X wasn't a particularly good chap, I might have said to him, oh, come on, this chap won't go down well, and he'd have put the thing into motion. But that would be purely unofficial.
Were they sending similar numbers in our direction?
No. No. As far as I know.
Mm. Oh, there was always, I think.
There's usually one here at Sandhurst.
Yes, there was one here at Sandhurst. Yes, there was. And, of course, with the DS and the Staff College.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. But I don't know how many others they had. I wasn't aware of the fact they had any others at all, no.
Mm.
Yeah.
Were there any transfers taking place on a permanent basis? You turned down the possibility of transferring.
No, I didn't come across one. And I would have done if one had come... if one had been successful, they would have come through me.
Anything else happened while you were in Australia that you want to record?
I think that's about all I can tell you about Australia. I got promoted there. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mm.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. It broadened one's vision enormously. And my wife thoroughly enjoyed it too.
What happened when you got back?
I got
3 years in Australia.
Before I got back, I received a most extraordinary signal. I'd been told I was going to be G1 in West Midlands District or some odd place in Shrewsbury. I thought, oh Lord.
Yeah.
Anyway, then I got a letter from regimental headquarters signed by John Graham, who was then the regimental colonel. You are required for special duty for the parachute regiment before going to your staff job.
Mm.
Well, to cut a long story short, the special duty was when I got home to this country. I had to take a complete military tattoo all round America for 3 months. And this was from September, October, November, 1970, I suppose. Yeah, 1969. And this, I thought, oh Lord, this is a terrible job. I didn't enjoy it at all because I had to do as I was told.
But isn't this rather similar to your Amsterdam expedition?
Oh, but that was minuscule.
Mm.
I had something like 400 people under my command, all the bands of the parachute regiment, the Gordon Highlanders, the Royal Corps Signals motorcycle team. It was like a royal tournament on wheels. And this was all being done at the request of the Americans. They wanted to see the British Army.
Gosh. Which parts of America did you take?
Well, we started off in New York.
Mm.
We then went all down the east board, right down to the south, down to Tucson and Arizona.
Mm.
Came up the west board and eventually finished up in Canada. Oh, we'd done the eastern cities of Canada before that.
This is Canada as well as the United States.
Yes. And then eventually we finished up our last forgetting the names now. It was the last American port, and called was Boston. We flew back from Boston. But this was after 3 months plus. A most exhausting performance.
Were you performing every evening?
Pretty well.
Mm.
And they wanted us to perform even more, and I had to be very strict with this American impresario. Yeah, most dreadful old man. And
what was his background? You say he was an impresario. Was he a military man, or was
not
he
the least bit? No,
he was a show business type.
Yes. And I better be careful what I say, but he tried to really work the chaps right into the ground. And we had a wonderful physical training team. Well, there's that, you know, the PT people going to do so much in 1 day.
Mm,
in
indeed.
Some of these places, it was mighty hot, particularly down in Tucson.
Mm.
And so he said to me, you're going to do this afternoon? I said, we are not. And so he said, well, what am I going to do? I said, I'll tell you, I don't know what you're going to do, but I don't know what I'm going to do. If you insist upon doing this thing, I'm getting in touch with the military attaché in Washington and ask for this all to be flown home.
Mm.
I'm not having my men being treated like this.
Mm.
Well, we had WREC girls in it as well.
Anyway,
I brought them all home. Not one girl was pregnant, and not one man had a horrible disease. So I was rather pleased about that. And my wife came as the medical advisor. Because I said, well, what about a doctor? Oh, there's no doctor. So I said, well, my wife's a nurse. Right, we'll take her.
Was this organised by the American military in any way? No, there was none at all.
It was purely
parachute
regiment headquarters to an impresario.
But I kept in touch with some...
Sounds rather like a questionable public-private partnership, if I can use current political jargon.
It made a lot of money for the parachute regiment, I told you that much.
Oh, did it?
Yes, and still does to a certain extent this day. Mm. The recordings, the bands were very good indeed.
Did it make a lot of money for the impresario?
Oh, must have done. I have no idea what it did. But he sent his representative with me, who was with me the whole time.
What sort of places were you performing in?
In huge arenas. We started off in Madison Square Gardens in New York, and they were all that sort of caliber.
Mm. What sort of audiences were you getting?
Well, that's a very good question indeed. Sometimes there were not all that number of people. Mm. I would think we never were less than, we would never have been less than 300 on one night, but that was nothing. Mm. And the whole place was practically empty. The majority of people, the majority of nights, I would say the average was about 800 people or more. That's 1,000. And but it was a very exhausting performance indeed.
But how were you travelling? Were you in
a Greyhound coach? Had a whole series of Greyhound coaches. Yes. Mm. I did in fact insist upon us being flown from, where was it now? Seattle up into Canada.
Would that be to Vancouver?
To Vancouver, is the name of it. To Vancouver. I insisted upon that, yes.
That's an awful long way, isn't it?
Long way, yes. Mm. So they did flights there, yes.
Mm. What was actually in the tattoo? What was the content of the programme?
Well, it was, I think I mentioned all the various units.
Yes.
And they all did their own individual thing. Mm. I mean, these wretched motorcyclists and so on and so forth. I see that... The motorcyclist team now, I practically scream. But no, they were very good indeed. Yeah. And of course, our PT people were absolutely first class.
Who had actually put the show together?
John Graham. Ah.
So he designed it and
he designed
booked
it.
The act, as
yes,
it were.
And wrote the programme. Mm. Well, he and I worked in together, of course. This was all done on one of the huge squares in Aldershot. Mm. And as far as the PT. Team was concerned, we were advised, of course, by the APTC at Fox Gym and so on. And we had an APTC sergeant major came with us as well. Oh, it was a very good show indeed. That there's no doubt at all.
Now, at this time, 1969, things were beginning to become difficult in Northern Ireland. There was trouble bubbling up.
Very good question indeed, yes.
Did you encounter any sense of that
we
in
did.
Boston or New York?
We encountered it in New York. Mm. In fact, we very nearly didn't get the first show off the ground because the Irish appeared en masse and we had to have police escort and so on to get us into the Madison Square Gardens. And then, of course, while we were there, we went down to Philadelphia as well. Then there was a knock-on effect because next year, you see, we had Bloody Sunday.
Yes.
And I had been made a freeman of Philadelphia. Mm. And regimental quarters of the parachute regiment, after Bloody Sunday, received a letter saying that, will you please tell the murderer, Colonel Corbell, that he is PNG, as far as Philadelphia is concerned. He is no longer a member of our city.
You say the Irish turned out. What did they actually do?
Oh, barracked. They didn't actually get into the arena, but they barracked us while we were going in. Shouting out anti-British slogans. Mm. They didn't throw anything at us.
Did this have any visible impact on the...
On the men?
On the men.
And the
women?
No, none at all. Mm. Absolutely none. None at all.
How were you received generally by the Americans?
Very well indeed. Mm. And we always had some nabob to take the salute every afternoon or every night. The mayor would turn up, or the governor of some province would turn up. We had the British ambassador at one stage. In fact, when we got to... On our last visit to Boston, we had Anthony Eden took the salute because he was just come out of hospital there, and he and Lady Eden came to take the salute.
Did you have contact with the British military mission in Washington.
I kept in touch with the British military attaché. Mm.
So were they sponsoring the...
They knew all about us.
Yes.
And now, yes. And I'm just trying to think of it. It doesn't matter. He became a major general. He took command in Hong Kong. Very, very, very pleasant man indeed. He was in the Blues. I ought to remember his name. Can't think of it now. It doesn't matter. But he was a very helpful man indeed. Very helpful.
So you had three months effectively with a sort of circus, you know, like a...
It was the nearest thing to a royal tournament.
Military equivalent of a...
It was like a royal tournament. Yes. And the mass bands were marvellous, all blended in with the Gordon Highlanders and all this sort of thing as well. I think that those were the main... I ought to have brought along a programme to show you, but anyway, it's a long time ago now. But it did a lot of good, and it, we were asked to show the flag, and we did show the flag.
Mm. You said you had this unpleasant letter from...
Chaps in Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia. Did you get any letters that were more appreciative as a result of this tour?
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, yes, we did. We got quite a number. Not to me personally, but to the regimental colonel.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. Oh, yes. Very much so. Mm. And lots of photographs. But and we were on their television as well. And I had been interviewed at breakfast one morning. Interviewed by them and so on. How did we like America and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Was this your first appearance on television?
I think it was, yeah. No, I'd appeared before with a guard of honour elsewhere.
Mm. But your first appearance being interviewed?
Being interviewed, yes.
So you came back from America and then you'd been threatened with Shrewsbury.
Yeah, thank God that fell through. And I was sent to Aldershot instead, to South East District, where I became G1 to a delightful man called General Bernard Penfold, who I got to know very well and still know to this day. Great friend.
What are the duties of a G1?
Well, you were the senior staff officer in the headquarters. I had staff duties, intelligence, and training, all came on my plate. And a lot of course, all this terrible business of civil defence came along as well, which was a rather boring performance. But we had a very good retired officer who ran all that. And I used to have a meeting with him every week to discuss these various civil defence exercises, which we had to take part in. Also, we were in very close touch with the police. We were the largest district in the army at that time, in that we had the whole of Surrey, Kent, Sussex and Hampshire. It's a pretty wide parish. So we knew all the chief constables very well indeed. And also we had a lot to do with London District, which suited me very well as a co-streamer, because the enclave at Pirbright, of course, came under the Major General in London. And, for example, we had the Queen's review of the Household Division took place in 1971, and this was a joint London District, South East District performance. It was a very interesting job indeed, very busy. I thoroughly enjoyed every moment. He's a wonderful man to work for.
Were you involved in any way with planning operations as G1? Was that part of it?
Yes, planning operations, yes, certainly, yes. Mm. You see, the majority of the troops in Aldershot at that time were all recruits. There was a large recruit engineer brigade there, at Cove. Of course, we had the parachute brigade there as well. So, yes, there was a lot of operations.
They were always on high alert, weren't they?
Oh, very much so, yes. They tended to work, of course, direct to Southern Command, as it was then, and the War Office. Mm. But, of course, we had to be in on the planning as well.
How large a staff were there in the headquarters at South East District in those days?
Gracious me. Including all the civilians as well. Mm. I suppose there must have been, you took them all in, about 100 people, I think, or more? Mm. Must have been. We had a photograph.